Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Plotlines. I'm your host, Connor, and today we are continuing a series that I started recently on Counter-Revolution, Altar and Throne, and Betrayal. And we're going to be talking about Altar and Throne today. We're going to be getting in sort of the basics of Altar and Throne, so as we continue the series, we can build on our knowledge and, you know, really understand how all three of them are connected and, you know, basically how necessary they are. And I have back with me the great Charles Coulomb, author and podcaster, as well as a writer for the European Conservative and many other places. Or, well, actually, you're a contributing editor, aren't you, for the European Conservative?
Yeah, that's what they call me.
As well as 1 Peter 5, So, welcome back to the show, Charles. How are you doing?
Thank you. Well, what can I say? It's springtime in Austria. The flowers are everywhere. The single remaining California poppy from last year that's going around here put out its golden head and all alone dreams of its far-off home in California.
Do you dream of California in Austria? Okay.
But when I'm in California, I dream of Austria. And actually, you know, I was in Ireland last month, and there's a song called Spencel Hill. A very sad song, but it ends with the words, "I woke up in California, many miles from Spencel Hill." Well, my second night in Ireland, I woke up and thought, I woke far from California, just a mile from Spencel Hill.
Okay. So Altar and Throne, really, the concept goes back very far in our history. And I think I want to start with a quote from somebody very much probably against the concept of Altar and Throne, at least somewhat. The former president. Can you hear me? Sorry.
No, I lost you.
Okay.
I think I I'm lost back. You. Former president.
Sorry about that. Okay. Former president Adolphe Thiers of France. He's quoted to say, "It is necessary that princes deign to recognize that monarchy is at a root a republic with hereditary president." And I want to. And, you know, how he's got the whole concept backwards.
Well, T.A. was a very backwards man anyway, so not to worry. I'm afraid you're coming in and out on me.
Sorry about that, everyone. My apologies. Did I finish the quote?
All I got was, say it again.
Okay. It is necessary that princes deign to recognize that monarchy is at root a republic with a hereditary president.
Au contraire, mon frère.
Indeed. And that is the point of this podcast, is to go through the historical aspects of why this is false and, you know, why he should be put in an insane asylum. But of course he's dead, so we can't do that.
Well, no, but they made him president or prime minister, which is the next best thing.
Yes, it's his own asylum, full of those, I bet, somewhere. They're just called presidential palaces or whatever.
Look at our very own White House.
Definitely in an insane asylum. Now, Charles, what does it mean for something to be sacred?
That is a very, very good question. And it comes from the Latin sacer. And basically it means something is withdrawn from profane use and given over entirely to the service of whatever the given religion or society considers divine. So, I mean, that's where we get a priest, sacerdos, is a man withdrawn from the common service and given over to making the sacrifice, the sacer fichio, the sacred man makes the sacred rite, you see.
Okay.
And so sacred, again, is withdrawn from the common life and given over to God, or whatever they may consider them in the given place.
So it's similar, I mean, to be set apart, that's it's similar to consecrate.
Yes, very similar.
Okay. Which makes sense because...
To consecrate is to make sacred.
Okay. And part of that is in the rite of coronation.
It is indeed. And the consecrate, you know, I told you the root of sacred was sacer in the Latin, consecrate.
Oh, okay.
Get it?
Yeah.
The sec is to make sacred.
Okay.
It's to with sacred to make.
Makes sense. I mean, so that's the basics of just the meanings of these words, but also when we go back all the way to creation days, Adam is basically a king over his domain, over the animals, and over the rest of humanity.
Yeah.
And then we see later Melchizedek. Now, I think I discussed Melchizedek with Dr. John Bergsma. I have a link to that in the description. We talked about biblical kingship a little bit, if you want to just focus on that. But Melchizedek, many people suggest that he might have been Shem, which is the son of one of the sons of Noah, I think.
Yeah, one of Noah. Noah had the three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth.
Yes. So that sort of paternal lineage is maintained amongst Shem. And, basically the way I see it is that God takes his people from patriarchy to community to a kingdom. And he has to do that, practically, because he starts off with just, you know, a few two humans, and then as humanity expands, so does this.
It's true, and you could say that in all of that development, there emerged three masculine roles: father, priest, and king. And they're with mankind throughout our history. And notice that each of them partakes of the other two. And by that, and this might require a little bit of explanation because the sad times we live in, but the king, via the coronation, etc., and you saw this very clearly in the Middle Ages, the king is the sort of mixed person. Partly layman, partly clerical. That's why even at the king's coronation a year ago, he wore the medieval style vestments, the dalmatic and the stole. Well, that wasn't just English. Most Christian coronations featured that. France, the Holy Roman Empire, and so forth. And there were other things. I mean, the Holy Roman Emperor acted as a deacon at papal masses. The King of France as a subdeacon. And that was all to show the priestly side of kingship. But the priests, well, they've got a kingly side to them, which actually you see most often in the confessional when they give you commands. But the priest, the kingly side, the priesthood is also brought out in the sovereignty of the Pope. And lastly, but not leastly, obviously both of these are supposed, both the priest and the king, are supposed to be fathers to their people. But a father, fatherhood in a sense, partakes of kingship and priesthood as well, because the father should be king in his own home, and priest in the sense of leading its religious life. You know, he's the one who sets the tone, says grace, makes sure the children know their catechism, etc. It was very much that way in my home growing up. My father was very definitely the religious head of the house as well as the temporal, and he very much saw part of his fatherhood as educating us in the faith and making sure we kept it, even if our Catholic schools were attacking it.
And studies have shown that if the father is faithful in, you know, is focusing on the religion, then the kids are more likely to retain the faith, opposed to just the mother, which is often the case nowadays, is that it's usually the woman has sort of often taken that role because the man has abdicated.
Yeah. Very true. And so that's why, you know, the further back you go, the more these three roles would be concentrated in the same person. But as you see, even today, each of them partakes of the other.
And Melchizedek is all three.
Yeah.
He's titled a king of righteousness.
Priest king of Salem.
Yeah, king of righteousness. I think that's what his name means. And then king of Salem means king of peace.
Yeah, and he's often seen as a forerunner of Christ.
So, and he, I mean, in principle, it shows that the main job of a king is to bring about peace.
Exactly. And the reason for that, of course, is that, you know, we'll get to this perhaps a bit later, but one of the most important roles of the Christian king is assisting the church in saving souls, the souls of his subjects. But one of the important ways for him to do that is to make sure the conditions are such that people aren't worried about whether they're going to get killed and can focus on saving their souls. So maintaining the peace is really, really important. And in fact, in all the different European nations, including England, which is where we get the phrase, the king's peace wasn't just a phrase. It was something that every subject was charged with maintaining. And the funny thing is that in the States, having picked up the common law, which is in its essence monarchical, we still use phrases like bound over to keep the peace, disturbing the peace, justices of the peace. And that peace is the king's peace. And yet, it was kind of an intangible thing, very Platonic ideal, because each of us, I say, were charged with maintaining it. But the way things worked in the Middle Ages, you know, someone starts playing the outlaw on the king's highway. What do? Well, the local lawman, whatever he's called, the sheriff, the magistrate, whomever it is, he sounds the hue and cry and pulls us all together. We go out on the king's highway. We catch the highwaymen, give them a fair trial, and hang them high. And the king's peace is restored. But what did the king have to do with that, you know, in his faraway capital?
Well, it comes from his authority. It's derived exactly from his power, his right to ensure the peace. It's exactly.
And that's why we're acting in the name of the king. You know, when you would have the sheriff or the cop knock on your door Open up in the name of the king.
One of the things is that I don't think it's, I don't think it's a coincidence, because I don't believe in coincidences, that the bloodiest war is, World War II, and there's barely a king really influencing the circumstances of that war.
No, it was done by the free representatives of the people who did their part and helped us all. And the same, even in World War I, the irony is that in Russia and Germany, neither the Kaiser nor the Tsar were really in control. And we know this because in 1905, they were first cousins, they were close friends. In 1905, they go for a cruise to the Baltic together on their respective yachts. They have a great time, and at the end of it, they signed a treaty of peace between Germany and Russia, a peace of alliance, which they vowed to get their allies in on. Well, what happened? As soon as they got back to their respective capitals, both of their governments denounced it. And all they could say about it was, oh, well, okay. You read the correspondence between them when the war was breaking out, and it's heartbreaking. And both of them are basically told by their governments that they can't do anything, and they just have to accept it. The Emperor of Austria tells in his cabinet, you wouldn't be so keen on going to war if you'd seen it the way I have. But they push the old fellow into it. And then during the war, where do you get, not at the very end when everybody's exhausted, but during the course of the war, where do you get the initiatives of peace from? Well, Blessed Emperor Karl, the Pope, Blessed Emperor Karl, King Albert of the Belgians, King Victor Emmanuel III of Italy, and the neutral King Alfonso XIII of Spain. And how much time? Sorry?
Wasn't the communication done through Xavier and
Sixtus?
Xavier and Sixtus of Bourbon Parma?
Yeah, the brothers of Zita, wife of Karl. Yeah, they were heavy couriers, as you might say. And then the other three kings I mentioned, all tried peace initiatives on their own initiative, and their respective politicians shot them all down. But at least they were the elected representatives of the people, giving the people what they needed, good and hard.
And deadly.
Well, as they say, careful what you ask for.
We have Von De Radio in the chat. He says, yes, knights were traditionally honored with a beautiful name of peacemakers, the peace of Christ through the reign of Christ. And then our Lord said, peace I leave you, my peace I give unto you is not as the world giveth. And he says, this is why he also told us, do not think that I came to send peace upon the earth. I came not to send peace, but the sword. What do you think about that last one?
Well, I mean, number one, because Christ said it, we have to take it. But also, there, way back at the beginning, God told Adam and Eve that he would put enmity between her seed and the serpent. And unfortunately, one of the results of the fall of man is that we don't like the truth. And acceptance of the truth or attempt to propagate the truth inevitably leads to conflict. But it's important that that conflict be for the truth and not for our own selfish reasons. It's interesting that in the Middle Ages, of course, all Christian countries were seen part of one Res Publica Christiana. And wars between Christians were seen as civil wars. The church did its best to banish them, but not being able to impose certain rules, the peace of Christ, the peace of God, and the truce of God, which forbade fighting between Christians on certain parts of the year and around certain areas. sometimes not get violated, of course, but if you did, you'd be excommunicated, which actually meant something in those days. So, but I mean, it is true that one of the results of the fall, and paradoxically of our redemption, is that there will always be a fight for the Christian with the world, the flesh, and the devil. And sometimes that leaves the internal sphere. And, you know, goes outward. Mm-hmm. Part of the problem for us is that for us as Americans, as moderns, we always want there to be a good side in every human conflict. Unfortunately, that's not always possible.
Yeah, exactly. Very true. Sometimes it's between people that are mostly good, and sometimes it's between very evil people.
Yeah, and you know, my late father had a wonderful phrase: "Rival gangs, same racket." who you get it back? Al Capone or Legs Diamond? You better choose. Got to choose. Got to pick a side here.
But I don't want to choose.
No.
How you responded?
What's that?
Is that how you responded to him, that you didn't want to choose?
Oh, well, yeah, of course. That's not a choice, really.
Yeah.
The choice is getting involved in a gang war. No thanks. No thanks. I see that ZenX has a message for us.
Oh, yes. Salutations. Could Charles please elaborate on the nature of monarchy to seemingly always be consecrated, be it in a Christian or pagan realm? Verbus unitis.
Well, sure. It's because kingship, it's one of those things, like the notion of sacrifice, that's part of our human nature. I mean, on some level, everybody knows we're fallen. On some level, every religion that has ever existed has known that there's been a rupture between heaven and earth. And so you have the whole idea of the sacrifice that, you know, there's many different kinds as there are peoples. But the same sort of overarching, and that's why there's been a priesthood of various kinds in just about every culture. Same is true of kings. As the old Welsh triad has it, three sacred things: scholars, graves, and kings. And that's it's a pagan way of looking at it, but more importantly, it's a human way of looking at it. You know, a lot of things that we do as Catholics, caters to the past. You can look at candles, use of incense, use of holy water. And one of the reasons certain kinds of Protestants will call us pagan is that we use these things, which were certainly used by pagans. But you see, their use is part of the human DNA. We know, as Tertullian says, the soul is naturally Christian. And we know on some very, very basic level, this concept of the sacred, the concept of the profane, and how we human beings are sort of twisting in the wind between them. Now, mind you, only in the church will you find the complete and true explanation, understanding of it. But all of the pagan peoples could see there was definitely something wrong. It's interesting to me that if you read Homer, and the Iliad and the Odyssey, the gods are portrayed as very human, very fickle, really, from our standpoint, not godlike at all. But they're treated with great honor and dignity and respect by the people of the time. Fast forward to Virgil, many centuries later, just before the time of Christ, And in the Aeneid, where he's telling basically the same story up to a point as Homer. What a different view. The gods are just the way they are in Homer, but Virgil doesn't like them. He doesn't like the fact that they're petty and all too human. And it was obvious that by the time our Lord arrived, Virgil was really, by the time our Lord arrived, Virgil was representing a desire for something on the part, certainly, of the Romans. A god who wasn't fickle, a god who wasn't petty, a god who was transcendent as well as operating in space and time. So, too, Christian kingship was a participation in the kingship of Christ. And so, in that sense, just as the Christian priesthood was the fulfillment of the reality of all the priesthoods that had gone before, to include the Jewish, so too with Christian kingship. It's important to bear in mind that our Lord, in his human personhood, was the rightful heir to King David. You know what you were going on earlier about with Melchizedek and with the Jewish kingship.
Mm-hmm.
Christ inherited all of that legitimately, and then at the Last Supper, he united it with the communio of the church. And from that time until about 300 or so, that reality wasn't that important, simply because we were a persecuted minority wherever we were. But starting in 303 AD, when Armenia came into the church, the king, commoners, princes, everybody, and culminating in 380 AD, when the Emperor Theodosius the Great made baptism entry into Roman citizenship as well as into the church. Well, this merger of communio and kingship took on life. And from that time on, a Catholic monarch was a participator in the kingship of Christ, just as the priest participates in his divine priesthood.
Indeed. Now, with Melchizedek, he gives his blessing to Abraham, and this kind of, to some degree, ends sort of for a time a human monarchy, or, you know, within sort of amongst the Hebrews. But then, as I said, it goes sort of patriarchy with Moses and Jacob. And then eventually out of Egypt, and with the leadership of the prophets. What am I thinking of? Who led them?
Of Samuel.
Yes, Samuel, the judges. And,
the judges, yeah.
Yes, and then the kingship and priesthood are reunited because it's been separated with the priesthood of Levi, and it's reunited under the house of David. Altar and throne are once more together. And a lot of the traditions that they Protestant Christians often criticize Catholics for, often the use of these things that were used by pagans, but also used by the Hebrews as well.
Well, yes, but you know, the Bible, if you're a real Bible Christian, you don't read the Bible. I mean, one of the things that always gets me is when monarchy comes up, somebody will always quote Samuel and God's apparent disapproval of monarchy. They love that. But the problem is they don't really know their Bible.
Indeed.
The thing is that already in the desert, God had decided on that Israel would have a king. And in Deuteronomy 17, 14, 20, he says, and I quote, "When you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations that are around me." See, he's foretelling what happened to Samuel. "You may indeed set a king over you, whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Only he must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt to acquire many horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law, approved by the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them, that his heart may not be lifted above his brothers, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment, either to the right hand or to the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel." Well, what that tells us is that when you look at Samuel as being God being annoyed with Israel for having kings, you don't know what you're talking about, unless you're Thomas Paine, in which case you originate the argument in order to get people to attack George III, and then laugh at them as morons afterwards, as he did to John Adams. Because, as you said, they took this argument that I put together for the Old Testament, and I don't even believe in it, which John Adams found sort of shocking. But that's all right. In the immortal words of that great theologian, P.T. Barnum, there's a seeker born every minute. And many a seeker has taken that reading of Samuel as opposition to monarchy. What it is, actually, is God's opposition to Saul, because they took a king to themselves initially who did not fit the criteria that God had envisioned for his people.
Well, also, God was basically ruling over Israel as sort of a personal kingdom of his.
In a way, but, you know, the rule of the judges degenerated.
Oh, yes.
And, I mean, I live in a country, or lived in the United States, a country that's been ruled by judges forever. And they found out in the Constitution that there was abortion and gay marriage, and all kinds of stuff. And then they found that there wasn't abortion. So I know all about rule by judges. It's so much better than a monarchy.
Inconsistency, very much so. But also the reason to be like the pagans was also disconcerting from what I understand. So if they asked for a different reason or just a more a legitimate reason, there wouldn't have been this consternation. But of course,
And notice also, though, that Samuel, who was certainly the best of the judges, he was the one who anointed David.
Indeed, so like the fact that God goes through with it disproves the whole concept that God would be against monarchy, especially on Earth. And
but again, a lot of Americans have absorbed this from Tom Paine. So my advice to you is, if you're going to be a Tom Paine supporter, that's great. But remember that he was an atheist. So if you want to use him as your great guide, you do that. But don't pretend to have a religion.
Indeed. And the kingship and this kingship that was granted to David, he was also adopted as a son of God, not the son of God, but a son of God, which foreshadows, of course, Christ himself, as well as our adoptions in baptism.
Right. Which, of course, adoption as sons of God is what we're all we're all aiming for, ultimately. Something that begins with baptism and finally culminates, we hope, in our individual salvations.
Now, one of the most interesting things is that so this authority goes all the way down to Jesus when he is born in Bethlehem, and he is born into the Davidic kingship. And it's one of the conversations with Pilate about his kingdom, and a translation we usually think of is his kingdom is not of this world, which is oftentimes misunderstood to mean that Christ doesn't have temporal kingship over the world, which St. John Chrysostom thoroughly disabuses us of in this quote I'm going to read. It is the kingdom of Jesus Christ, not of this world. It is certainly these words, it is not of, do not mean that Jesus Christ does not command in this world, but he also has his kingdom in heaven. And this kingdom is not human, but far greater and more brilliant. He said, I am not of the world. He says that his kingdom is not from here in this sense, which does not exclude the world from his kingdom, but rather shows, as I have said, that his kingdom is not human, nor passing, nor perishable.
And that, I mean, you see very much the same thinking all the way down via St. Thomas Aquinas and Robert Bellarmine and God knows how many writers, culminating in Pius XI and, I can't think of the title of it, but it was the encyclical establishing the Feast of Christ the King. Well, that's really annoying. But there, I'm not going to rely on my faulty memory. Going senile is fun from the inside, believe you me. Quas primas. I don't believe I forgot that. Quas primas.
Sorry, what was that again? What is that?
The encyclical that Pius XI wrote describing the kingship of Christ in the modern day is called Quas Primas.
Now, there was a big to-do over, you know, the term Christ is King, or the phrase Christ is King on X recently. And one Catholic pro-life activist did a whole thing about, basically almost, I'm not going to say she totally disagreed with what I read and the kingship of Christ, but she definitely was urging Christianity to be less a part of the state.
Well, you know, that's like urging your soul to be less a part of your body. That's called dying. The fact of the matter is that from the 300s until the Protestant revolt, because of the circumstances of the Last Supper and their application to the real world that I described, the church, the Christian church, the Catholic church, and the state were seen as different facets of the same Res Publica Christiana. And as a result, as I say, in 380, Theodosius the Great made baptism entrance into Roman citizenship as well as into the church. And from that time on, until the Protestant revolt, this was why heretics, Jews, and Muslims could not be full citizens of the body politic. To put this another way, in looking at the Catholic state, the church was, in a sense, the form, and the state itself, the matter of the body politic. Now, with the Reformation. And oddly enough, this didn't change in Eastern Orthodox countries, except that the Guelphs triumphed over the Ghibellines, and in the end, the Imperium collapsed. In the East, the opposite happened. And what you might call the Ghibelline strain defeated the Guelphs, and so the church became completely subject to the state, which also isn't good. You see, a lot of these things, in my humble opinion, are supposed to exist in creative tension, like the relationship between male and female. And if either side ever wins, you get a disaster. The kind of disaster depending upon which side wins. Anyway, I digress. So with the Protestant revolt, what happened was that the countries that took the religious revolution, created their state churches, which took the place of the Catholic Church in society. Bishops in the parliament. But because there were state churches and branches of the state, they could no longer be independent, nor could they be the conscience of the king. Precisely because and then those who held on to the Catholic faith were now outside the body politic, which is why we were persecuted. Now, in time, the externals of all that survived, but it was emptied out. And as it became progressively emptier, we Catholics were able to get a place at the table again in those countries. But in Catholic countries, the system I've described could only be destroyed through violent revolution, and it was. And the interesting thing is that because we Catholics today are used to that kind of a setup, we've forgotten that what we have is not really the way it was intended. You see, it's a bit like if you're thrown out of your house and you get used to living on the street and being homeless, you may forget that that's not really normal. But I've got other people living in tents on the sidewalk beside me. We have a regular neighborhood. We hang, we chat. We got it going. Yeah, but see, you're supposed to be actually living in a house, not in a tent outside. But you forget, you see, and we've forgotten. Now, to make it even funnier in a sick way, the relationship between church and state, as I say, in the Catholic state, we were intended that the church, is, in a sense, was the form and the state the matter. Well, now what you've got is a disembodied church and a state that's like a zombie. With the soul of the state gone, it's got another spirit, and not a good one.
No.
So, in a sense, what you could tell your friend, your pro-life friend, when she says that the church needs to be totally separated from the state, we have that, and the result is dead babies. And euthanasia. And gay marriage. Because understand, the state will never be neutral. It will be animated by an animating principle, a spiritual sense. It might be communism, as it was in the Soviet Union. There is no God and Lenin is his prophet. But there is no such thing as a neutral state. And there's really no such thing as separation of church and state. My church may be separate from the state. Oh, yes. But some church, some belief will animate the hulking zombie that is the modern state. And if it's not us, it'll be something else. And what experience has shown is that something else is deadly, disgusting, and all-powerful.
It's certainly not the Protestants.
Well, no. I mean, as I say, you look at England, you look at Sweden, Norway, Their church structures are intact. The ceremonials, all quite lovely, are still with us, and they serve as reminders, or should serve as reminders for Catholics, as to what our position should be. But they have no real control over anything. Instead, they have the same state religion that the United States do.
Yeah.
And that every Spain does, Portugal, Italy, they all have the same state religion.
Moloch.
You bet. What's that?
Moloch.
Yeah. And what's wrong with that? Who are we to tell our owners what they should believe? That's what I want to know.
Well, you're a Californian.
Well, see, there you go.
Which so is the pro-life woman, too.
Well, you see, and California, of course, it didn't escape my notice when they voted in the pro-death amendment. It had an even larger proportion than the re-election of Governor Newsom. Nor has it escaped me that my two native states, New York, the state of my birth, California, the state where I lasted longest, two worst governors in the country. nor my two cities, LA and New York, two worst mayors in the country. Don't think I haven't caught on to this.
Well, it's probably gotten worse without you there.
Obviously, my presence didn't help a lot.
Well, you might have been holding something worse back.
The Calicon.
Yeah, exactly. Another example of the kingship of Jesus, you know, in the Bible that we often don't look to is, we don't see necessarily, is the Magi in their coming to visit the child Jesus. They are basically submitting on behalf of the rest of the world, not, you know, the pagan world, to Christ.
Very true. And they've been seen, they've been seen also as representatives of the three different races of kingship itself. And of course, as Magi, they were kind of priest kings on a very low scale.
Pagan scale.
Yeah. But see, again, that tells us something. The fact that through their arts, whatever they were, they knew when and where Christ was going to be born. Obviously, there was some validity, some factual validity to what they were doing.
Well, weren't they looking at the stars? Weren't they studying the stars?
Yeah, they sure were. They sure were. And they, and there again, you know, just like Maundy Thursday was considered a very royal day. And in all the Catholic courts around Europe, the foot washing was a big deal for the given king or the emperor. From Portugal, Spain, the Italian countries, Germany, the Holy Roman Empire, Hungary, Poland, the kings of all those countries washed the feet of the poor on Maundy Thursday, hearkening back to the beginning of Catholic monarchy at the Last Supper. Well, similarly, the Epiphany was a big day at Catholic courts. And from Portugal to Russia, on the Epiphany, they would present gold, frankincense, and myrrh at their respective royal chapels to, in emulation of the three kings.
Indeed. Now, another element of, so I was reading, and I quoted twice from John Hani's book, The Sacred Royalty. One of the things that he proposes and that I'd never heard of before, and I want to ask you if it's sort of a orthodox perspective, is can we see the cross being Jesus's throne, and was the crown of thorns, or you know, in some sense, a real coronation?
Well, actually, that's a metaphor, you might say, that has been used quite a bit. And certainly the the instruments of the Passion in total, the cross, the crown of thorns, the holy lance, for that matter, the cup of the Last Supper, the holy grail, the sponge, that the wine and all that was delivered to his lips. These have all, they all became very important for the various courts of Europe. When St. Louis IX received the crown of thorns from the Emperor of Constantinople, from that time on, the thorns were sent as gifts to various royal courts by the king as a sign of, you might say, royal solidarity. So now when you see the relic in Notre Dame Cathedral, or when you will again when they reopen, there are no thorns left. But you'll find them scattered in various royal and other treasuries around Europe. You find them here in Vienna, in the Hofburg. You find them at the Vatican. You find them, I mean, he sent them all over the place. And in a few places, they bleed on Good Friday.
Really?
Yes. Indeed, you can see it all in my book on the Holy Grail. Not that we're
is that a plug?
Making a plug. Oh, I'm sorry, it slipped out. No, not a plug. Not me, not ever.
Well, just so you know, I have lots of links for Charles's works, books, a playlist that he's been on with me, links to Tumblr House for his work there, all sorts of stuff. So if you're interested in more Charles, check the description of this podcast.
I have to say also, I've just noticed there's a note there from a comment from Peter Barlow.
This one?
Yeah, that's the one. Now, it has been suggested that the Magi were members of a Babylonian order of esoterics founded by Daniel, and were thus Jewish, or at least influenced by Jewish tradition. I have heard that suggestion, and Lord knows there are a lot of there's a lot of speculation, a lot of theories, a lot of ideas about just that kind of thing. The problem with all of it, of course, is A, it's impossible to know for sure, and B, probably this side of the grave we won't, but the speculation is a lot of fun. Now, the other thing I have to mention, Peter Barlow is the, how do I say this? Well, he's described himself as the Ed McMahon of bespoke clothing. So
who's Ed McMahon?
Boomer alert, warning, boomer alert. Ed McMahon was the sidekick of Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show for many, many, many years. And I'm sorry, sometimes I'm reminded I'm very old, but at any rate, the podcast he does is called Ask Oki, and it's concerning clothing. You see? Bespoke clothing, suits, and formal wear, and all that. So I can recommend it very highly. Ask Oki, O-K-E-Y. Not O-K-I-E, as in someone from Oklahoma, who you probably would not ask about. I'm not saying Okies don't know about proper clothing. I'm not saying that. But this Oki is a person, a man, and he's got nothing to do with Oklahoma. And Peter Barlow is his, his Ed McMahon.
I am definitely from a different generation.
Yes. I like the name Didymus.
Yes, indeed. Very good name. Yeah. He's a good follower of the channel. Now, why would Daniel found an esoteric order?
When people say esoteric, they immediately think witchcraft.
Okay.
All esoteric means is secret. That's all. So, for instance, I'll give you an example from our own history. The Disciplina Arcani, the discipline of the secret. The doctrines of, they didn't say transubstantiation then, but of the real presence, were not told to the unbaptized. Mm. In other words, before in the early church, when we were being persecuted, if you were a catechumen, you weren't told about the change of the bread and wine into our Lord. That was only revealed to you after you were baptized, which is why in the Latin Rite, up until 1969, you had what was called the Liturgy of the Catechumens, which is the first part, all the scripture readings and so on and so forth. And then the second part was the Liturgy of the Faithful, where you have the actual change from bread and wine into our Lord's body and blood. You have, and then the Byzantines, some of the Byzantine rites have retained the dismissal of the catechumens, because in those days, knowledge of transubstantiation, the real presence, that was esoteric. It was secret. It was hidden from the many, and only revealed once you became a full member of the church through baptism. However, one of the ways we know that they believed in the real presence, even though it was a secret, is that it was from garbled accounts of the whole thing. That one of the charges leveled against our forefathers was cannibalism.
Indeed.
Which would not have been the case had, you can see exactly, if you think of transubstantiation being A, a carefully guarded secret, B, you know that how people are and how they'll talk regardless of type of time, then C, you can see how the charges of cannibalism would arise. And because all the baptized were sworn to secrecy, they really weren't in a position to refute it.
So if it was, so, but like if Daniel did found an esoteric order, it's very unlikely we'd know about it.
Well, we wouldn't know much except the fact of it happening. I mean, it's like when people ask me, what do the Freemasons believe? Well, I can tell you their public teachings, but I can't tell you their secret teachings for a very important reason.
They're secret.
Can you guess what that is?
Yeah, they're secret.
Yep. It's like, you know, what do you think about the conspiracy of this, that, or the other? Choose your poison. Well, if I knew, I'd be a member, wouldn't I? And then I wouldn't tell you. Mm-hmm. Although I can reveal to you the truth about the Kennedy assassination.
Really?
Yep.
And?
It was a CIA plot to kill Governor Connally that went terribly wrong. Now, I should mention Neo-Thomist 8182 is quick to say, and for your information, those of us from Oklahoma are quite dapper in our dress, gentlemen. Well, I'll take your word for it. Pretty Boy Floyd got his name for a reason. You know, I don't know if he was a dapper dresser. I don't know.
I don't know either.
It's a great song.
Now, an important aspect of sort of post Jesus's ascension is that, as well as the Pope takes on sort of the spiritual authority, or takes on a spiritual authority granted to him by Christ, and the throne is in some ways, you know, and you said sort of not firmly, but it's in some way separated from the priesthood, not fully, but.
It's distinct is the best way to put it.
Okay, distinct.
It's distinct from the priesthood. The state of the church are distinct. And the priesthood, you see, there was an interrelationship between the church and the state that was very complex. So, for instance, on the one hand, very many bishops, abbots, and so forth, had various secular responsibilities. All the canons, for instance, of the city of Lyon in France were counts. The minute you became a canon of Lyon, you became a nobleman. Regardless of where or how you were born, you were suddenly a count. You had, of course, in Central Europe, in Germany and Italy, and in part of France, and the Diocese of Durham in England, the bishops and or the abbots could be secular rulers as well, or if not a secular ruler, the local lord of the land. That was all on the one side. But then on the other, you had kings like the Holy Roman Emperor, the King of France, the King of England, who were canons of different churches. So the Holy Roman Emperor, for instance, when he was crowned, became a canon of St. Peter. The King of France became a canon of St. John Lateran. Now, there were a lot of other churches in Rome, in France that he was also a canon of. Interestingly enough, the president of France today is a canon of St. John Lateran.
Have there been non-Catholic presidents as of recent? I mean, isn't Macron not really a Catholic?
Well, look at Biden. He's baptized. He's a pretend Catholic.
Well, but Biden's not a canon of anything.
Well, no, because then we don't have that in our system.
Sure.
But Sarkozy became president, there was a bit of joking that he was the first divorced canon they ever had in Rome. But, similarly, the King of England was the canon of St. Paul's outside the walls in Rome. And the abbot of St. Paul's until the break was the prelate of the Order of the Garter. And that's why if you go to St. Paul outside the walls today, the monastery, to walk in the gardens, you'll see the garter's coat of arms up with the Onis Vaki Mali Pons and all that. Somebody just asked how Masonic is the French Novus Ordo, I wonder. Well, I'll tell you what. They got pour la multitude instead of pour tout, which is something that gave our English translators a little trouble.
What does that mean?
Well, in the canon of the Mass, in English, German, Spanish, and most languages, they translated pro multus, for many, into for all.
Oh.
But the French was one of the very few that got it right.
Okay. Gotcha.
So, not as Masonic as the English speakers, I would say.
But okay,
also, you'll never find an eye in the pyramid on a French bill. So there.
Okay. Well, Charles, how important, I mean, given the fact that the king is the bringer or sort of the keeper of the peace, or well, it is his peace and that he keeps, and a bringer of justice, and, you know, in some sense, would he be wielder of one of the two swords, you know, the temporal sword wielder, but not like owner, right? The Pope owns both swords,
The Pope owns both swords, but the king operates it. And of course, and this is where it gets a little bit wiggy. Both Innocent III and ZX wants to know, isn't the eye of the triangle a symbol of the Counter-Reformation? Actually, you're correct. It was. It's a perfectly fine symbol of the Trinity. But then starting in the 17th century, the Freemasons took a hold of it. So you have this thing. I mean, it wasn't a Masonic symbol in Spain until the 19th century. So Father Serra's chasubles at California museums all have the eye of the triangle on the back. When I take people to see them, they look and they go, oh, well, why does Father Sarah's chasuble have an eye on the triangle? I tell them, because California was a Masonic plot from the very beginning. And then they're on the next plane out of state. It's wonderful. But at any rate, to return to your question.
Ignore the chat for the time being.
Yeah, I will. You know, it's a little bit like squirrel.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, all right, I'm sorry, what were we talking about?
I think I was saying how important, given the fact that the king is the keeper of the peace, or it is his peace, the Pope has both the sword, temporal and spiritual, but the king is the wielder of the temporal sword, for most part. I mean, the Pope, well, I guess, and the Papal States would wield both. But but in this case, how is it? How important is it that a restoration of the alliance of altar and throne to the restoration of society?
Well, it depends on what kind of a society you want.
Restoration of Christian society, of Christendom itself. Like, why is counter-revolution connected with altar and throne? Why is it necessary to have both?
Well, one of the reasons why counter-revolutions have failed so much and so often is that all the counter-revolutionaries had in common was that they were against, which was, oddly enough, the rebellion.
They were what?
Sorry. I'm not falling for it, Didymus. Not falling for it. I'm not looking.
No, they were what? What'd you say?
One of the reasons why counter-revolutionaries fail so regularly is because they do not, they have a vision of what they're against,
okay,
but not of what they're for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the biggest problems, I think. If you look at the White Russians fighting Lenin and the gang, you look at the counter-revolutionaries in Germany against Hitler, you look at country after country. One of the few places where they were able to pull themselves together was in Spain under Franco. And that basically was worked because Franco, A, controlled the biggest bit of the power, and B, told everybody what they wanted to hear. And, you know, they were able to pull together sufficiently to defeat the communists. But that was not sufficient for a long-lasting establishment. Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, and we see in our own time, you know, Spain, as soon as Franco was dead, they did their best to rush to the bottom of the sewer with the rest of us. You know, and swim in the excrement as the rest of us do. So, to answer your question, it's important to have some notion of what it is we're in favor of. What is it we want? I say we advisedly because the likelihood of my being around to see anything better than the garbage we have is unlikely. But certainly you folks have a chance at it. And, you know, you've got the, you know, there are two things you want to avoid. One is being so doctrinaire that you become irrelevant and break into a bunch of tiny schools fighting over trifles. The other is to be so practical and so open that you don't really stand for anything. Somewhere in between those two extremes is where a successful reform of society, a successful counter-revolution, if you will, has to be. And it's important to remember, too, that there's nothing that is unimportant in this particular quest. Whether it's pushing for the major issues in life, like not murdering infants, you know, like not slaughtering the elderly and the infirm, you know, things like that.
You just care because you're getting old.
Nah.
I'm just kidding.
Believe me. Y'all made me a martyr. You're doing me a favor. See you on the other side, morons.
that's no,
I tell you what. Make a martyr out of me. I'll die laughing. But the thing, which could be a little bit disconcerting to my biographers, I think.
Dying laughing. You know,
well, if you look, somebody gets martyred by the evil morons in charge, right? Now, normally you expect to hear him forgive his persecutors and say something wise and uplifting. If all he does is point at them and laugh and die, I mean, that's not a very uplifting story, if you ask me.
I'll have fun with your biography.
Gosh, I shudder to think. No, I actually, I was asked once if I'd ever write at all a biography. And I found an answer from an English lady who was a writer in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And her response as to why she would never write an autobiography fit me perfectly. She said, if I wrote what I know, it would be too scandalous to print. If I wrote what I think proper to read, it would be too dull.
Well, that's why you need a biography by, you know, written by somebody else, because they'll have a mix of the two.
Ain't happening.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry?
No, continue. What are you saying?
No, so the long and short of it is that the thing to remember is that the state, the Catholic state, has its proper sphere. And it doesn't simply exist purely at the beck and call of the Holy Father. But it can't really be in opposition to him either. And of course, this is precisely the area where you had conflict in days gone by. What this would look like in the future, it's hard to say. But one thing you got to bear in mind when you're looking at the whole church and state thing, at the Catholic state, all this, remember that these were byproducts. They developed organically from the conversion of the classical world and the barbarians to the Catholic faith. They didn't set out to create it. It just came that way. It developed naturally. It's sort of like if you look at the Benedictines in Europe, and you remember that they did not set out to save European civilization. That wasn't the reason for doing what they did. It was a byproduct, and they did it. You know, thank God they did it. Thank God for the byproduct. But seek ye first the kingdom of God and his justice, and all this will be given unto you. So when you look at counter-revolution, and what an alternative society might look like, bear in mind there's only so much that you can plan beforehand. A lot of it will simply come to pass as things improve. If the United States, for instance, to take one little example. A little piddling example, ruled by little piddling men.
We lost you, Charles. Or I lost me. And you guys type if you still hear me in the chat. Just let me know if you guys can hear me. Oh. Charles is back. Charles, stop making those hand gestures. Okay, everyone can hear me. We're working on getting back Charles. I think he's doing his hand gestures. Didymus, I think you can find, I'll put one in the chat. I'll put my email in the description of this episode later. Well, it seems like we kind of lost Charles, and I'm not sure when we'll get him back. I do have a Discord, Sebastian. Again, I'll... afterwards, after this episode, I will add that link to the description. So both Didymus and Sebastian, I will put emails, or I'll put an email and the Discord link in the description for you guys later. I don't know what happened to Charles internet-wise, but I think, I'm not mistaken, what we were last talking about is sort of unity of, oh, never mind, he's back. Hello, you're back.
Yeah, apparently my internet went out.
Indeed.
So, restored again.
Okay. Where do you know where you were?
Not really. What did I say? Why did
you say that? Well, we're talking about the necessity devoting yourself to God, and that things will come about in yes. counter-revolutions.
Yeah, they will. I mean, you do have to have some idea of where you want to go on the one hand, but you don't have to worry too much about the exact details, because those will come about in and of themselves. When the United States were to convert, its institutions and its people would alter accordingly, organically, naturally. Believe me, the pagan Franks were not the people of Charlemagne. The pagan Anglo-Saxons were not the people of the Venerable Bede, nor the people of the Middle Ages. We shall change. And of course, for the counter-revolution, for the opposition to all this horror, there are several different areas in which one has to work. One is the religious, and that means evangelization. One is the political, and that means fighting to preserve what's good and to try to stop what isn't. And that varies from place to place. You know, if you're a Canadian, then you want to, on the one hand, preserve the monarchy, and on the other hand, try to suppress abortion and that kind of thing. It's yeah. different if you're an American. You have a different set of issues. It's different if you're a Brazilian. It's different if you're in Abu Dhabi. The thing is different in every place. The third element, of course, is cultural. And we tend to forget, when we're thinking purely about politics and religion, that everything from cuisine to couture is actually in itself kind of a battleground. Not as big, not as important perhaps, but a battleground nevertheless, and one that has to be fought over.
Yeah. Indeed.
You know, defending the good, the true, and the beautiful in any sphere is a stroke for the right.
Are you familiar with Carl Benjamin? Have you heard of him?
No, I can't say that I have.
Well, he's a he's an Englishman. He was big on YouTube, and he came up in sort of like, you know, probably 6 or 7 years ago on YouTube, very popular. And he always called himself a liberal, and now he calls himself a traditionalist. And he's still an agnostic. Like he can't bring himself to believe in God at the moment. But basically he recognizes and states that we need a positive vision, as you're saying, in order to succeed.
Well, absolutely. Because it's not enough just to be against things. And, you know, Dawkins or Hawkins, somebody recently of the
Dawkins,
camp.
I think.
Yeah, Dawkins came forward and proclaimed himself a quote unquote cultural Christian. Well, that's better than nothing, but it's, you know, the guy still needs help. You could be like the great American writer Henry Adams, who came to France. He was a Yankee, a Brahmin, really, just a grandson of John Quincy Adams. But he was just bowled over by Mont Saint-Michel and Chartres. Then he wrote a book of that name, Mont Saint-Michel and Chartres, which really was about the superiority, in a lot of ways, of medieval civilization to the industrial civilization that he had grown up with. Now, he followed that up with a similar piece, The Virgin and the Dynamo, talking about the two engines of medieval versus modern society. Get it? The Virgin, meaning the medieval, and the Dynamo. Mm-hmm. But none of this brought him into the church because he couldn't quite get over the whole faith thing. And you got to pray very hard for people like that because they see through a glass darkly. But they do see more than most. I feel a bit that way about Orson Welles, oddly enough. Hmm. I know you've never heard of Orson Welles. It's okay.
No, didn't he play? He's an actor. He played Wolsey, I think, right?
Yeah, but he was a lot more than that.
Well, yeah, but that's what I know most from.
The funny thing is that although that's a very good version of Man for All Seasons, Charlton Heston had tried to get the role.
Oh, really?
And he failed. So about 20 or 30 years later, he did TV version.
Really?
Yeah. And one of the things he resurrected, which I don't think they had in the movie, I could be wrong, I don't remember, is that there's this character who's sort of the everyman. And he's Thomas More's steward, he's a messenger, he's all sorts of underlings, but it's all played by the same actor.
Yeah, they had a butler in the main, like, he kind of did that in the Man for All the Man for All Seasons movie.
Ah, well, at the very end, and this is true with the play, I don't remember it in the movie, but I saw it in the TV and the play. At the very end, this everyman character tells you how everybody died. You know, and he goes, mm-hmm. this, that. Then he says, oh, and me? Oh, well, I died in my bed, as I hope shall all of you.
Hmm. Interesting. They did something akin to that at the end of the movie. But very interesting.
It's kind of, what's the word? Spine chilling.
Yeah, spooky.
Yeah, because, of course, he represents us. You know, you have these great figures, the martyrs and their persecutors. And then you have the rest of us who are just follow.
Indeed. Well, Charles, it's been lovely talking to you. I will be doing a lecture on Thursday about this same topic, taking what we've discussed here and putting my own little flair to it. And going maybe deeper. I don't know. We'll see what happens. So that will be Thursday, same time. Check out Charles on all the different places down below. European Conservative, Tumblr House, the Never Ending Struggle, as well. And make sure you please like, share, and leave a comment on this video. It really helps the channel. And I'm like 9 subscribers away from 2,000. So please help me get to 2,000 subscribers.
I'm not a math major. I'm trying to figure it out. All right, 9.
9. Right. I said 9.
Yeah, 9. We need 9.
We need 9 subscribers. Anyways, Charles, anything to say before we go?
Yeah. I have a toast for the Jacobite days. Are you ready?
Okay.
Bearing in mind that they called the Jacobite heir to the three thrones, they called him the pretender. So it goes like this. God bless the king. I mean the faith's defender. God bless, no harm in blessing, the pretender. But who be that pretender? And who that king? God bless us all. It's quite another thing.
Okay. That's how it ended? But God bless everyone. Bye.